Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcasts, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, NHK Japan, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We will begin with France 24. The European Union passed a nature restoration plan, a part of the European Green Deal. Each European Union member will need to restore 20% of its land and sea ecosystems by 2030. On an edition of the program called Perspective, an interview with Pam Pearson of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative. The cryosphere refers to all frozen water on Earth, including glaciers, snow, and permafrost. An increase of 2 degrees centigrade in global temperature will begin an irreversible trend to rising sea levels. France 24.
It's the culmination of a long battle within the European Union.
That's really a relief.
Environment ministers from the bloc's 27 countries meeting in Luxembourg have backed the nature restoration plan. Finland, Hungary, Italy, the Netherlands, Poland and Sweden voted against it, while Belgium abstained. And after opposing the text in March, Germany this time voted in favour of the legislation, meaning it can now pass into law, following months of setbacks. The plan requires member states to introduce measures restoring nature on a fifth of their land and sea by 2030.
It's a clear signal that the protection of the environment and nature is important for our future, for the existence of us all, for agriculture and for forestry. It's therefore also a sign of better protection for our population.
The vote had just enough support to pass, with Austria's environment minister defying her conservative coalition partners by pledging to back the policy, because, she said, the health and happiness of future generations is at stake.
My decision to support this law has been intensely debated. I know I will face opposition in Austria on this, but I'm convinced that this is the time to adopt this law.
Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer promptly responded that his government would file a complaint at the European Court against a, quote, unlawful vote. The nature conservation law aims to restore ecosystems in the EU, preserving forests, waterways and farmland, and halting the decline of bees. A watered-down text compared to the initial version, not least because of the fears of some farmers, but nonetheless hailed as an historic victory by environmental NGOs.
Now it is time for today's Perspective guest, and today is the UN World Day to combat desertification and drought. And to mark that here on the World Today, we're going to talk now about the cryosphere, the term for regions of our planet, of course, that are covered in ice and snow. Areas then at major risk from both drought and temperature changes. Now, in its latest report on the cryosphere, the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative headlines by saying that a 2 degrees rise in temperature would mean that all of the Earth's frozen parts would experience irreversible damage, with disastrous consequences for millions of people, societies, and of course, for nature. Joining us now is founder and director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative, Pam Pearson. She's a former US diplomat, 20 years of experience working on global issues. Thanks very much for being with us on the programme today. If there was then a 2 degrees rise in temperatures, what could that mean?
You know, this is in a way the third kind of crisis that's happening right now. It can be very difficult to focus on this with Gaza, with Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But the reality is this crisis is going on right now, and it will indeed be irreversible. Parts of it are right now already. There's a very good chance, for example, that the West Antarctic ice sheet has already tipped, but we can slow it down so that we're probably looking at maybe 3 meters of sea level rise that we can no longer stop, but we may be able to stretch it out to 800 or 1,000 years. Glaciers, especially tropical glaciers, are disappearing incredibly quickly right now. And Venezuela lost its last glacier, La Corona Glacier, sometime in the past year. And so these have inevitable consequences for humans. Just this morning, the group ICIMOD, which is an international organization focused on the Himalayas, advised the countries in that region to prepare for drought this year because snow is at a record low amount in river basins such as the Indus. And so this is ongoing. It's sort of the slow crisis, but the inevitable crisis. And it's something we have to focus on and that we can still prevent the worst of if we can stick to 1.5 degrees. But unfortunately, we're not on that track in any way, shape or form right now.
And those kind of rises of sea levels, what does that technically mean? How much of the land mass is that effectively going to be swallowed up by the sea?
Well, that still depends on us, right? Because it can be as much as 3 meters early next century. That would wipe out, for example, most of southern Bangladesh. The capital of Dhaka would become an island. The country of the Bahamas would be wiped out entirely because it's all pretty much below 3 meters. Probably just with 1 meter, about 200 million people, according to the IPCC, will be displaced, even with 1 meter of sea level rise. So 3 meters is incredible. But the thing with ice is it responds slowly, but once it responds, you can't stop it. And that's the kind of alarm we're trying to raise. Because when I'm talking about these very high levels of sea level rise, 2100, you know, these 3 meters, that's just the beginning. If we've kicked that in, the IPCC has said up to 15 meters cannot be ruled out by 2300. And the important message is if we go down later, if we can bring temperatures down after peaking at 2 degrees, these processes can no longer be stopped at that point. And if we reach 3 degrees, and we're aiming for somewhere between 2.5 and 3 degrees right now, even if all of our current commitments are met, then at that point, these really high levels probably become inevitable and much sooner than we thought.
It's very difficult, isn't it, for a lot of people to kind of visualize exactly what it means, particularly if they live perhaps in big cities. Me sitting here in Paris, for example, I mean, that brief glacier that you mentioned, La Corona, becoming too small to be classed as a glacier, makes Venezuela, doesn't it, the first country in the Andes Mountain to lose all its glaciers. It's something concrete that people can kind of get hold of and really understand.
Exactly. And it won't be, you know, the last country to lose theirs. There's these tropical glaciers are really tiny. One of the last tropical glaciers, really the only remaining glaciers in the Pacific, is on the border of Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. That is disappearing inevitably. Sometime in the next 2 years, that glacier is going to be gone as well. And so this is simply going to continue as long as we keep on pushing fossil fuel emissions really into the atmosphere. There's nothing we can do to halt this process other than to bring these down really, really sharply and as soon as possible. So that's why this is so urgent. It's not something that it's okay to delay it until 2040 or 2050, because then we're going to be pushing these dynamics into place. And again, we won't be able to stop them.
Do you despair a little bit with politicians and, to be honest, with voters as well? I mean, we've just had the European elections a week ago, the Green Party doing very badly in those elections. I mean, as you mentioned, people perhaps are too busy following the situation in Gaza, following the situation in Ukraine, other conflicts, other major issues around the world, to perhaps concentrate enough on environmental issues.
Right. And that's the danger. But I think then it's really up to the scientific community to bring it home and to talk about how this has an impact on people's daily lives, that the heat that we see, that the lack of water that we see, that's related to the world's ice. So these areas seem to be really far away from us, but in reality, they have an impact on our daily lives. And I think that's really up to us to communicate. And again, to communicate the irreversibility that we cannot bring this back. You know, I think a lot of people think about climate change sometimes like air pollution, right? And if you can bring good air quality back or good water quality, you know, decrease the pollution, things will go back to the way they were. That's not how the cryosphere works. Once it kicks in, it keeps on going. And so really, if we lose the cryosphere, in a way, we will lose the planet that we know, because it's going to go into a different state. And so it is urgent, even though it seems so very far away.
And what can people actually do about it? I mean, I was sitting around the dinner table on Friday night with a lot of younger people in their early 20s, and they were saying, we just don't know what we can do other than doing a little bit more recycling than we do. You know, what else is there that people can kind of actually physically do to try and solve these problems?
Well, I mean, probably the most important thing they can do goes back to your earlier comment. They can vote, right? They can vote politicians who are eager and willing to take this seriously and to address it with the urgency that it requires. But also just decreasing your own carbon footprint as much as possible and encouraging others to do the same, because that's really the only way that, that we can act on this. But there is so much that can be done by individuals to cut down on their carbon footprint. And if this is seen as a priority by everyone, we can really have an impact.
Pam Pearson, director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative.
That report and interview are from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. Russian President Putin signed a defense pact with North Korea, with 23 articles including mutual military support and economic cooperation. China sent a delegation to South Korea with the stated goal of resolving conflicts on the Korean Peninsula. The Secretary General of NATO says that they are modernizing its nuclear deterrence with new fighter jets capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reported an increase in the number of deployed nuclear warheads on the planet, with 90% of them in the U.S. and Russia. 90 countries attended a Swiss international conference on peace in Ukraine. Russia was not invited, and the major countries in the Global South did not sign the final communique. Ukraine passed a new military draft law, which only a third of the Ukrainian population agrees with. NHK Japan.
Putin's trip comes fresh off signing a defense pact with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The deal underscores how Pyongyang and Moscow are aligning to oppose the West. The state-run Korean Central News Agency published the details of the agreement on Thursday. It consists of 23 articles, including a promise of mutual military support in the event of war. Article 4 stipulates that if either country is invaded or pushed into war, the other will immediately deploy all means at its disposal to provide assistance. It says this must be done in accordance with the United Nations Charter, which recognizes a member state's right to self-defense. Article 3 requires the countries to hold talks to remove possible threats of military aggression. Article 8 states the two will take steps to strengthen defense capabilities and protect global peace and security. The treaty also specifies cooperation in a wide range of fields, including the economy, science, and technology.
Now to Seoul, where China and South Korea have held high-level diplomatic and security talks. South Korea expressed deep concern about Putin's visit to North Korea, while the Chinese delegation stressed the need to resolve issues over the Korean Peninsula. Vice foreign ministers and senior defense officials took part in the meeting on Tuesday. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and Chinese Premier Lee Chang agreed last month to hold a dialogue. This is the first time vice-ministerial-level officials have met under the framework. South Korean officials stressed Putin's visit to North Korea should not lead to a strengthening of illegal military cooperation. Seoul added such a move would undermine China's interests and called on Beijing to play a constructive role to promote denuclearization as well as peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. The Chinese side reportedly responded by claiming it's fulfilling its role in resolving issues concerning the peninsula. They added Beijing's policy on the matter remains unchanged. Observers say Seoul may have sought to drive a wedge between China, Russia, and North Korea through the meeting.
NATO's Secretary General says the Transatlantic Alliance is modernizing its nuclear deterrence to adapt to the current security environment. Jens Stoltenberg was speaking to reporters in Washington on Monday. He said NATO is replacing its older fighter jets in Europe with a newer version capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The move comes amid the ongoing nuclear threat posed by Russia. Stoltenberg said at the NATO defense ministers meeting in Brussels last week that the alliance needs to be able to clearly communicate that its nuclear deterrent is effective, secure, and reliable. Stoltenberg is in the U.S. ahead of next month's NATO summit in Washington.
A Swedish think tank says the number of nuclear warheads in the world deployed with missiles and aircraft has risen since last year. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute released the finding on Monday in its annual report. It estimates that the total number of warheads around the world in January was 12,121, down 391 from a year earlier. An estimated 3,904, or more than 30%, were deployed with missiles and aircraft. That is an increase of 60. Russia had the most warheads at an estimated 5,580, followed by the United States with 5,044. The two countries are believed to possess about 90% of the total global inventory. China is believed to have the third largest stockpile with about 500 nuclear warheads. That is up by about 90 from a year earlier. The report's authors believe that tensions over Ukraine and the Gaza Strip have further weakened nuclear diplomacy. It cited tactical nuclear weapon drills conducted by Russia close to the Ukrainian border in May. The report states that nuclear weapons have not played such a prominent role in international relations since the Cold War. The authors say we're now in one of the most dangerous periods in human history. It's time for the great powers to step back and reflect. Delegates to an international conference on peace in Ukraine have adopted a joint communique. The official announcement includes a pledge to address issues such as the safety of nuclear power plants. Russia was not invited to the two-day summit. The conference took place in the Swiss city of Bürgenstock. It was held to discuss a peace plan put forward by Ukraine. Representatives from about 100 countries and organizations attended. The meeting ended on Sunday. The communique says the participants have decided to take concrete steps in three areas, including nuclear power plant safety and food security. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed his intention to create an action plan to implement his peace proposal. He also said he wants a second peace summit to be held. Swiss President Viola Amherst stressed the importance of the conference, but she indicated a critical challenge lies ahead.
One key question remains. How and when can Russia be included in the process? We have heard it in many of your statements. A lasting solution must involve both parties.
The participants from some of the emerging countries, collectively known as the Global South, pointed to the need for Russia's participation. Those nations value their ties to Moscow. Diplomatic sources say about 10 countries did not support the communique. Saudi Arabia and India were reportedly among them. The Kremlin's spokesperson Dmitry Peskov criticized the Ukrainian side. He said the matter is they won't talk about peace.
Ukrainian lawmakers have addressed the shortage of fighting forces by passing a new military mobilization law. But a poll suggests only a third of the public supports the legislation. Authorities have barred men between the ages of 18 and 60 from leaving the country since the start of the war. But they brought in new rules last month to crack down on draft dodgers. They require men of fighting age to register their addresses and family information with the military within the next month. Defense officials say about 2 million of the estimated 4 to 5 million eligible men have already completed their registration. Pollsters with independent research firm the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology asked people whether they support the law. 34% of respondents said they completely or somewhat agree, and over half said they completely or somewhat disagree. The pollsters say President Volodymyr Zelensky, in particular, has experienced a decline in approval ratings over the law.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they are heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. My online support information is available at my website, outfarpress.com. Many thanks to everyone who has ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please keep it up. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. More about the two-day summit in Switzerland on peace in Ukraine with a reporter at the summit and a Deutsche Welle political analyst. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The two-day summit on peace in Ukraine has drawn to a close in Switzerland. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the support his country received from world leaders shows the international rule of law can be restored, though the summit's final communique stated all parties must be involved in talks to achieve lasting peace. Russia wasn't invited and didn't show any interest in attending. The document reaffirms a commitment to Ukraine's territorial integrity and calls for control of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant to be returned to Kyiv. Our chief international editor, Richard Walker, is here to walk us through the diplomatic maze of disunity over the war. But let's go first to Rosie Burchard. She is at the peace summit for us. Rosie, could you tell me if a sense of unity has emerged from the conference?
Well, there's a couple of ways of looking at this, really. I've just emerged from some press remarks made by a series of leaders here, and they all try to strike really an optimistic tone. We've heard from President Zelensky saying the fact that more than 90 countries were gathered here is a show of support for Ukraine, a show of solidarity for Ukraine, and it is the highest level gathering of this type. It's a first of its kind summit. But that, Ben, is not the whole story, because as just before this press conference began, we were sitting in the press room here and suddenly flashed up on screens all around the room a list of countries which had signed up to the final joint communique of this summit, and there were some names missing, some notable big hitters that attended the summit either by sending an envoy or a minister but who refused to sign up to a joint communique, and they include India, Indonesia, South Africa, the diplomatic heavyweights, many would say, of the so-called Global South. So there, a fractured disunity emerging, if you look at it from that perspective. Still, though, Kyiv claiming this as a success.
Okay, Richard, tell us more then about India, Indonesia and South Africa, what they think about Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would definitely underline the way Rosie was just putting it there. And I think in the case of some of these countries, it's not so surprising, but there are one or two countries where maybe it is a bit disappointing from the point of view of Ukraine. So let's just take a look at what was in this communique, yeah? So that these countries were having to decide whether we put our names to this or not. And basically, the communique was a pretty short document with just, you know, relatively small number of points, but very much framed from a point of view that is supportive towards Ukraine. So referring to the fact that this ongoing war of the Russian Federation against Ukraine continues to cause large-scale suffering around the world, saying that the threat or use of force against territorial integrity or the independence of any state is to be ruled out. So very much kind of the tone of the language coming from the point of view of support for Ukraine. Some of those countries have been much more independent in in international votes, say at the United Nations, there have been these votes in the UN General Assembly, particularly early on in the war. India has always, for example, abstained in those votes. So it's maybe to be expected that when a document like this comes up, which is very much kind of framed from a pro-Ukraine point of view, you might expect India to sit on the fence, as it has done throughout this. But Indonesia, for instance, voted for Ukraine at the United Nations. In fact, I saw Volodymyr Zelensky just recently in Singapore at a summit where he came partly to try to persuade the Indonesian incoming president to take part in this process. He didn't take part. He sent a low-level envoy to it. And then Indonesia sitting out on this document. So I think some of those countries that did not sign up for that really will be quite disappointing for Ukraine.
So what's got to change? Does the wording need to be made more vague? I mean, is that going to get us any closer to peace?
Well, the thing is, I mean, it depends like how you look at what this conference really was all about. And of course, the big criticism that some countries internationally have had is like, how can you have a peace conference when like one side of this war is not even present, when Russia is not present? Now, of course, Russia showed no interest in playing a role at this and therefore didn't get an invitation. But China also sat this out, of course, Russia's biggest friend. So the question is like, what was the purpose of this? I think from Ukraine's point of view, it was about rallying support, trying to show to the other side, look, we've got 90 plus countries coming along to this conference, many of them with very high level delegations. That's the kind of diplomatic support we have out in the world. It may not be uniform. There may be some countries that are still a bit on the fence. But this is a kind of effort that Russia cannot put on. And then take that as the starting point to go into some process with Russia. And that, well, the communique does make that clear, that at the next step, if we look forward, where does it go from here? That they have to start finding a way to come to some sort of process with Russia. But of course, we've heard from Russia in the last couple of days, we've heard Vladimir Putin staking out his position. He's sounding like he has no interest in making any concessions. So there's certainly a very, very long way towards before we could get to any meaningful talks.
Rosie, can you just give me the outlook from where you are briefly?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the question of whether Russia should be here was so much on the lips of everyone here. And we certainly just heard the Ghanaian president saying he regretted that Russia couldn't be part of it. But certainly Russia, just ahead of these talks, released its own, what it purported to be a kind of vision for peace. But it was really dismissed by Western leaders and by Ukraine as nothing but a bid to distract from and derail this summit, because it essentially asked Ukraine to capitulate. And what that shows is that even as this summit closes and Ukraine saying it feels supported by more countries than ever across the world, that the positions of Russia and Ukraine remain very far apart. And of course, on the battleground, the war rages on.
That report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as most podcast sites. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look harder these days because of US and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from a spinal injury, I'm staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.